Finance and Revenue Committee to order. My apologies for starting late. We had to wait for our rules to arrive so that we know what we are adopting to run our committee by. This is our first meeting of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. We have everybody but one here. Two, four.
Jason's outside.
Senator Atkinson's outside, and Senator, who else are we missing?
Senator Westland.
Okay, but we will start out forthwith on our rules. These are standard rules. Or Mr. Warner, would you like to give any further elucidation on the rules?
Very briefly, Madam Chair, that there is a 24-hour notice requirement for initially scheduled bill for public hearing. And then anticipation of going to 1 hour notice later in the session. You can carry over any bills you need to that is posted one day to the next, as long as it's the same schedule for the same. In other words, if it's scheduled for a work session, then it can be carried over for a work session. In terms of subcommittees, remind you that a subcommittee is different than a work group. A work group doesn't require formal notice or is not a public meeting. A subcommittee has all of the trappings of the regular committee. So those are the only things that I wanted to bring to the attention of the committee.
Thank you very much. Senator Morris, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move adoption of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee rules as presented.
Senator Morris has moved adoption of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee rules. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We are now official. For those in the audience, we're going to go a little bit out of order today. I think I'll save the work plan till the end.
Okay.
We are going to start out with Senate Bill 1060 and 1081, and then we're going to take up Senate Bill 1101 and do Senate Bill 1082 last, and then we'll have a brief discussion of our work plan. So we will open now a public hearing on Senate Bill 1060.
Chris is down.
We will switch councils here, switch staff here, economists. We will switch economists. I've been on judiciary too long. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1060 is pretty straightforward. It's just a simple clarification of a law that you passed last session pertaining to TRICARE tax expenditures. There was, during the administrative rules process, the Office of Rural Health felt that there was some ambiguity in the law in terms of the number of certificates that could be issued in tax years 2008 through 2011. The intent was to have that number ramp up, be 500 in 08, then 1,000, and then 1,500, and then 2,000. And so this is a simple clarification of that law. And consequently, there's no revenue impact.
We have Brigadier General Mike Caldwell honoring us today with his presence. Welcome.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. Frankly, I was kind of surprised to see this because I thought that, and perhaps maybe this is my ignorance in the process of the rural health, but the whole intent of the legislation was to try to increase the number of TRICARE physicians that serve military members. The stipulations of 500, 1,000, et cetera, from what I've been reading and getting from the insurance industry, that really basically all that's going to cover is who's already on board, who's already serving our soldiers and their families when they're deployed. So, in essence, if that's the case, then all we have done is reward those folks that have already stepped up. And the intent was to clearly expand this and try to get more physicians and medical providers into the system. I don't know that, you know, this may be technically the right thing to do. I testified on the bill when it came up in the 07 session. I had no clue that there were going to be limits on the 500, 1,000, 1,500, and 2,000. Like I said, I thought the intent of the legislature was pretty straightforward. You know, let's give these folks a tax deduction if there's one, or there's 1,000. And now we're narrowing down the throat of the gate so we can squeeze people through, and I'm not sure it's going to get to where we wanted to go with this. And I just remind the committee that In a year from now, we'll be mobilizing 3,500 Oregon Guardsmen. We've got 600 in Iraq right now, and we're going to be mobilizing 3,500 Guardsmen to go off to Iraq next summer. So the situation is not going to become less of an issue. It's going to continue to be a larger one. Now, it could be a matter of the Rural Health Office simply, and I don't know if somebody's here from Rural Health or not. You may want to listen to them, but this may be a situation where they simply don't have the ability, the manpower, or the wherewithal to go out and get this, you know, take care of all this. And that could be maybe what your able staff has picked up through this rulemaking process. But if this is what's necessary to make the thing go, that's great. But I don't think we're kind of stretching this thing out. By the time this war is over, we may have enough docs. And God only knows when it's going to be over. But the way it's going, it may be a long time. But so that's my testimony. I put on your sheet that I was neutral, because but I think it's, I wanted to make sure the committee understands the reality that we're living with every day and what we see. So I'll take any questions you may have.
Thank you for your testimony. I think it's my understanding that this bill does what we thought we were doing in the regular session. And the way the bill was phrased, there was some doubt whether we could even go to the 1,000, 1,500, and 2,000. So at least this will give the full scope of what we thought we were doing in 2007, where there was some doubt about that. Is that correct, Council?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
And I would certainly encourage you to bring this back again. I know the Office of Rural Health has also had a wish list around this area, and certainly we want to do everything we can for the people who are serving in Iraq.
Again, I would, Madam Chairman, I would just, it must be a workload issue is the only thing I can think of. What would be so wrong with striking everything from B, C, and allowing D be the only one, A, B, and C, striking them in 2,000? What difference does it make? Why do we graduate at 500, 1,000, 1,500, 2,000, 1,500, 2,000? That would be the only question I would have. What's the difference if it's 2,000 or 500?
Right away. Well, for one thing, the revenue impact would be quite different. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
So the way this is phrased now, we don't have a revenue impact to struggle with. And after Friday, I think we're going to be even more aware of the consequences of that.
I certainly appreciate the balancing act you all have to do, and I wouldn't question that. But it's again, our objective was to get more, not less, and that was the whole purpose of this. I'm going to come up here in 2009, and I'm going to say we had a great bill, and all we did was take care of the people we just had. We didn't gain one doc, and that was really we got to remember that was the objective. How do we gain more doctors? How do we gain more medical providers? This is an experiment. I totally understand that. Just so the committee knows, in 2009, we'll probably say, well, we took care of those guys that were on board, but we didn't gain that many. So, and maybe that's the real issue. Maybe the issue is that we look at it from the new guys, but then we would punish the old guys as well. So I don't know if there's a fair way to do that.
Well, but this was for new people entering TRICARE. This bill was. Otherwise, there would have been no point in having the bill in the first place. These are new people coming to TRICARE. These are not the existing people. And what this bill does is it allows more new people to come in than the interpretation of the old bill did. So I think it still is an improvement. Otherwise, we would never have even needed a bill in the first place.
Again, that was not my interpretation. It was anybody that was in it actually got it. And if that's how it's being interpreted, then indeed, the new people would get a tax deduction. The old folks that have been with us all along, they're just there. It's got its problems.
Yeah, well, it's a much bigger problem than TRICARE.
Yes, it's called a war. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee?
Thank you.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I remember this bill pretty well, and I remember the frustration that your Senate Revenue Committee had in 07 in learning about this issue, and the fact that, in fact, the federal government had dropped the ball again in terms of the level of TRICARE funding and made it cost prohibitive for many doctors to join the system and to serve our veterans, and that we as a state were willing to pick up some of the cost of serving our veterans because the federal government was not doing what they should be doing, the level of funding they should be. And so that was the reason for this bill, was to give a little added financial incentive to doctors to join the TRICARE system and accept the very low level of payment that they got from the feds under the TRICARE system, so that our veterans, who we all love, admire, and respect, will have access to proper medical treatment. The difficulty in the interim has been whether or not these are cumulative, or the amount, the 500 a year that's added, are cumulative, or not, or just the same 500. Has been a misinterpretation of legislative intent. This bill clarifies what legislative intent was in the 07 session. Doesn't do anything more, doesn't fix it to any greater degree, it just codifies legislative intent from 07.
Thank you.
We wish we could do more.
Well, and just, you know, I think that again, it isn't the state's issue. It really is the federal government's issue, and I think we all understand that. And you can't blame the medical providers, because they're getting the same rate for these patients, our patients, and their families, as they get for Medicare and Medicaid. And I've talked to numerous physicians, and they'll just flat tell you that if they took Medicare, Medicaid, and TRICARE, they go out of business in about 6 months. So they got to balance all that. So it's going to take more of these folks in there to do that. And I totally 100% agree that the federal government ought to step up, and they ought to make it whatever the highest Medicaid, Medicare rate is across the land. TRICARE patients ought to get that, no matter where they're at, because Oregon gets punished under that system. And I think that's a federal issue. And I think we passed a resolution last session to tell our delegation to please pursue that. I think they have within their limited ability to do so, but nevertheless, it is a federal issue, and we need to continue to bring it up to their level and beat the table till they do the right thing, because that's really what needs to happen. Then I think these problems would be a lot easier dealt with. I will also comment that under the new TriWest system that took over this contracting, their payments are quicker. They're within the same rate as Blue Cross Blue Shield. I think they've done a marvelous job that this company has of getting those payments out to these medical providers, and that's helped. And a lot of them have said, well, it's a different system now, and maybe we'll try it again. So that's helped as well. But it really is the root of the problem, is right down to that care level. I can't understand it. It doesn't make a logical sense to me why the federal government would operate this way, but then I guess that's why we got a federal government.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, just a final comment. I heard a news report on the way down today that 24 veterans a day in this country are committing suicide. 24 a day are committing suicide, and that rate is way higher than it was a few years ago before the Iraq War. Part of that is because we're not providing the mental health as well as the physical needs of those returning veterans. And so this senator, anyway, is going to do all we can to try and not just say, the feds, you dropped the ball, but say, okay, the feds, you dropped the ball, but in the meantime, we're going to do what we can.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to, if anybody else want to talk on this? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1060, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 1060. Senator Morris, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the adoption of Senate Bill 1060 and that it be referred to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 1060 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Monroe, would you like to carry this?
I'd love to carry this bill.
It's all yours. Okay, now we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1081.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1081 is the latest version of the federal reconnect bill. This one is pretty bland in terms of there not being many changes to federal law in 2007. If I could point your direction, in your stack there's a summary sheet of Senate Bill 1081, and it's kind of a section by section just to highlight exactly what the reconnect is doing in each of those provisions. And as you know, we have a rolling reconnect to Oregon tax, the definition of Oregon taxable income. This bill, for the rest of the statute, we tie to federal IRC as of December 31st, 2006. This would simply update that to December 31st, 2007, thereby tacking on any changes made in 2007. And for the thickness of the bill, most of the sections in the bill pertain to the definition of charities. In one way or another, we have a property tax exemption for charities, and the definition we use is in the IRC. So this just updates that definition to the most current at the federal level. And that's what that summary page does. There are a couple of other places in statute where there's an income definition used for example, for the Elderly Rental Assistance Program. That's available to individuals whose income is below a certain level. And for purposes of that program, income is defined as federal adjusted gross income. And this would be updating that from 06 to 07. It has a minimal impact. Again, there wasn't much by the way of tax legislation that passed in 07. One example of something that passed that was contained in the Small Business Tax Act of 2007 was that at the federal level, for married couples that file a joint return and are operating an unincorporated business, they are no longer required to file as a partnership, but instead can file two Schedule Cs. So adopting this would allow them to file the same way for Oregon. And the revenue impact on that particular example could go either way. It depends on how the income is distributed between the two. But that's the source of the minimal revenue impact.
And so it will be minimal?
Yes.
Regardless of how it goes. Okay.
Right.
All right. We have Jim Craven and Chuck Sheketoff signed up.
Individually or together?
I don't know, because Mr. Sheketoff did not say where he was on this bill, so I'm assuming he's for it.
What do you say?
I'm heartily for it.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven, American Electronics Association. Very briefly, I think we support Senate Bill 1081. I think this is an example of one of the benefits of annual sessions. Whatever you feel about whether this is a good or bad idea, one thing that I think two things that you're seeing here today in the committee. Annual sessions allow us to fix the oops, we goofed, or that's not what we meant, kind of, and you have a couple of those before you. Senate Bill 1081 allows us to speed up connection to the federal code, which we do on a biennial basis by being in session in an even numbered year. We're allowed to conform our code to December 31st, 2007, which does all the things that you've heard about over the years, makes for ease of filing, gets rid of a lot of amended returns where people have to go back and recapture federal provisions and true them up with their state returns. So Oregon has had a policy of rolling, so-called permanent or rolling reconnect on definitions of income. So for things that wind up as defining of income from your federal return that you carry over to your state, we do that on a permanent rolling basis. You don't need a bill to do that. What this bill does is connect to those other kinds of things, congressional enactments, that we don't automatically true up to. So we think it's a good bill. It's a good public policy for Oregon, and one of the benefits of being here in February 2008.
Thank you. Questions?
Well said.
Thank you. Mr. Sheketoff.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Chuck Sheketoff, Oregon Center for Public Policy. I'm supportive of the bill with a but, and it's what the bill is absolutely missing, and a little history is in order. I can remember in 1997, after the legislature had adjourned and Governor Kitzhaber's tax policy group started meeting at one of their very first meetings, Paul Warner was explaining what the 97 legislature had done, and he said, and we went to automatic reconnect, rolling reconnect. And Dick Munn was on that panel for the reviewing the tax system, and he said, oh my God, why'd we do that? We made that mistake 20 years ago, and it cost us, and we ended it. In 1969, the legislature referred to the voters an amendment allowing us to connect to the definition, automatically connect to the definition of federal adjustable incomes, the only, one of the few areas that we give lawmaking authority to an entity outside this building. In 1971, after the legislature had adjourned, Congress enacted some changes that cost Oregon dearly. And so subsequently, the legislature doesn't require rolling reconnect the constitutional provision. It just allows it only on the definition of taxable income, not for the estate tax and other things, right? And so the legislature ended rolling reconnect in the mid-70s because it cost them. They learned from their mistake. The 1997 legislature went to rolling reconnect. Then when the 01 recession hit and you were going into special sessions, Lane Shetterly, to his credit, great credit, worked with staff and across the aisle in this building, and we suspended rolling reconnect. We think it should just be go back to what we learned in the 70s. And it was suspended with a sunset date. It was a simple majority vote because it was out to the, it set it into the future, so you couldn't, so it wasn't raising anybody's taxes. And it had a sunset. And unfortunately, the 05 legislature let the sunset expire, so we went back to rolling reconnect. Which we did a little paper on it saying Albert Einstein would be rolling his grave over rolling reconnect. You know, he is the one who said, if, you know, insanity is doing something stupid over and over again expecting a different result. Rolling reconnect is dangerous. Now, Jim's point about annual sessions, you now have a window of opportunity. Congress is about to pass, and the president is about to sign, some sort of stimulus package. The chance of them not doing it are fairly slim. The least effective one, according to Moody's.com, Moody's Economy.com, not exactly a liberal think tank, was the bonus depreciation provision. It's going to cost Oregon approximately $100 million. My certified smart people friends in D.C. have calculated that, and I think your staff will probably confirm that, your certified smart people. $100 million. In the 01-02 time period, we were unable to, Congress had acted, and we were unable to muster the three-fifths votes to get out from underneath it. You today, with a simple majority, could end rolling reconnect right now. And you can, and we think you should do it permanently, maybe do what was done in the 02 special session of having it sunset so if you think the future legislature should keep revisiting that decision. And then at a even more minimum, quickly say if Congress acts on bonus depreciation, we're not recognizing it. Because that's going to cost you. And when you have your revenue forecast on Friday, turn to the state economists and say, does your forecast calculate the effects of the stimulus package? My bet is it doesn't, in general to the economy, because no one really knows what it's going to be yet. And specifically to the revenue impact on Oregon, do you have bonus depreciation there, or is that a potential $100 million down from your numbers?
Are you saying that by getting rid of rolling reconnect, we would that would automatically disconnect us from that?
Right. If you got rid of rolling reconnect in this bill, mm-hmm. signed by tonight, and Congress later acts and does bonus depreciation, the 09 legislature would have to decide whether to connect to that. You'd have to make a decision to affirmatively give up $90 million versus a decision to take away $90 million that some large corporations primarily are getting from the break. And that might require a three-fifths vote, depending how it's constructed or how you different legal opinions in the building. If you matched it up with, well, we can get avoid a three-fifths by giving up other revenue, just do it. And so we think it should be, you should preserve your rights by addressing that in this bill. This is the vehicle. Like Congress and the Senate has not acted on their provisions yet, and they're going to have to go to conference with the House in D.C. And so you have a short window of opportunity this special session to do something and protect the fist.
Madam Chair?
Craven.
Just a couple points. One, nobody really knows when or exactly what will be in a congressional stimulus package. I would agree with Mr. Sheketoff that it's likely to contain some provisions for bonus depreciation or accelerated expensing. A couple points on that. That bill could be signed by the president as early as early next week. So asking this body to rush into a preemptive disconnect strike is is an interesting challenge for you. A good part of what may be in that federal stimulus package is accelerated depreciation for small businesses, not all the money going to large corporations. The idea is to encourage small businesses, just as we did in 2002 at the federal level, and we had this debate in this room in 2002 during the special sessions, is to encourage a small business to make a purchase that they may otherwise delay because of their concerns about the softness of the economy. In reality, when you accelerate depreciation, it's a timing issue. Instead of taking, say, a 5-year write down on an asset, you write it down in 1 or 2 years. So in years 3, 4, and 5, it goes back on the tax rolls at full value, and the federal government and the state will get the value of that asset in an outer year. It's really a timing issue rather than some massive giveaway. And I think the federal bill that I'm looking at tries to target the bulk of those bonus depreciation expensing to small business. There will be provisions that all businesses can take, for sure, if what we're looking at comes into play. The other point to make is, and I know your staff is working on trying to give you numbers. They're trying to estimate something that isn't federal law yet. I realize that's probably a challenge. There'll be provisions in that federal stimulus package that add revenue to the state of Oregon. The sort of federal kicker, the federal tax rebate chicks. That provision will actually be a benefit to the state of Oregon because it will reduce federal deductibility. So anytime Congress makes a tax change, sometimes there's pluses, sometimes there's minuses. We continue to believe, as we worked with this committee in 1997 and subsequently, that Rolling Reconnect is a good policy for the state of Oregon, and we're not too enamored of every time we have a little blip in our budget or there's a congressional enactment, let's pick and choose, let's disconnect from the minus and connect to the positive, creating a great deal of uncertainty and difficulty for taxpayers, and taking away from Oregon companies the full benefit of the federal stimulus package.
Okay, I would only say that this is one Reconnect bill. There's another bill or two in the House, and this is going over the House, and the issue that you brought up, Mr. Sherkatov, is not an unfamiliar issue to me. So I wouldn't rule anything in or out at this point, but I think my goal today is to get this one on its way, and then perhaps in another forum in our very short session take up some of the other issues that you mentioned, which are good issues given what Congress is about to do.
So I will respond to Mr. Craven in that forum then.
Okay, very quickly, please.
No, I can do it in that forum. I will tell you that MoodysEconomy.com rated all the components of the stimulus package. The one that rated the best at either $1.27 or $1.37 or so for every dollar invested, return on investment, was increasing food stamp benefits. That's not in either the House or Senate packages. Then there was extended unemployment insurance, the rebates, and the lowest one was the estate tax that had no return on investment, and bonus depreciation had about 24 or 27 cents return on investment. There have been numerous studies of what happened 5 years ago, and they've shown it did not work to help slow down the recession or shore us up. It's very inefficient. And he is correct that we will have we'll get more revenue from the rebates. I will remind the legislature that out of an issue for fairness, that people who are itemizers should get the full rebate and shouldn't be taxed on it, essentially. You forgave $16.9 million in 2003 to allow itemizers to fully benefit from the rebate. So now you're going to be faced with that question. That's a simple majority vote. Do you give up that additional revenue? And so I don't see it as a matching puts and takes. I think this is a direct loss, and it's a separate issue of whether you give up additional revenue that may come in under an argument of fairness that itemizers should get the full rebate. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you both. Any other questions? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1081 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1081.
Madam Chair, I move the adoption of Senate Bill 1081 and that it be referred to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 1081 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I will carry this. Okay, now we will open a public hearing. Are you running that one too? We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1101. Mr. Allenbach.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1101 modifies, makes some technical corrections and clarifications to House Bill 2592B, which the Assembly passed last session, and this is the bill that deals with non-resident real estate withholding. You should also have a dash one amendment that I haven't looked at yet, but that should also be in your packet, and it's put together as a gut and stuff, although my understanding is that that was just the easiest way to draft it, that the differences between the dash one and what you have in the drafted 1101 are not that different, although I haven't had the chance to look through it yet. But what 1101 does, it clarifies the language pertaining to the withholding of income taxes for certain real estate transactions. It clarifies terms and definitions. It also changes the amount withheld, the calculation there. That calculation is the least of either 4% of the consideration, the net proceeds of the conveyance, and prior to that it was 4% of the net proceeds, and that didn't really make a lot of sense because the net proceeds are always going to be less than the consideration, or 8% of the gain that would be included in the transfer's taxable income down from 10%. What that would do with our top tax rate of 9%, that would just in all likelihood reduce the number of refunds that would be going out when these taxpayers filed their tax return. It also modified the list of cases where withholding is not required by listing out various cases that largely pertain to cases where the judicial branch has gotten involved. And if need be, I believe Kate Toswell is here to talk through some of those details. But the theme there is that in many of these transfers, there is another government official, maybe perhaps a judge, that's involved with the transaction. So the chance of noncompliance with tax laws is probably much less rather than some other transactions. It also allows the Department of Revenue to collect interest on the withholding if it's not remitted timely by the authorized agent. And it also imposes a penalty of $500 or 10% of the amount to be withheld, up to $2,500 in cases where that wasn't the case. It also clarifies when the Department of Revenue may not proceed with collections, and that would be cases where the money was withheld and remitted timely, cases where there is no requirement to withhold, or where there is the written affirmation indicating that the transfer would not owe tax. It also allows the Department of Revenue to establish rules for granting a waiver for cases in which money was withheld under the current law before this becomes law. It's possible, I guess, that there's a case where money was withheld now and they're in compliance with current law, but when this bill becomes law, they may be out of compliance. And this allows the Department of Revenue to just grant the waiver to say everything's fine. The revenue impact that I have put in there is at minimal, and that's largely because the revenue impact that's on there from last session was mainly due to compliance issues. A lot of the money in here is not a new tax. Under current law, and even prior to last session, these taxpayers owed the liability. It was just a matter of how they remitted it. In many cases, they should have been either making an estimated payment or paying the money when they filed the return. By requiring withholding, it does a couple of things. It raises a flag and an issue to non-residents who perhaps may not be aware that they would owe tax if it's a taxable event. And so most of that money is from compliance. And a couple of things about the bill that I missed there. It focuses some of the definitions, and for example, at the beginning of the bill, it makes the withholding only applicable to licensed escrow agents. And so that's a little tighter than the, what was done before. And examples where that might not be, the, where somebody might be exempt from this is if it's not a licensed escrow agent. So you have a lawyer handling the transaction, then the withholding wouldn't apply to them.
And it's perfectly legal to have a lawyer instead of a licensed escrow agent. Is that correct?
That's my understanding.
Okay.
But it's also my understanding most of the cases, to date anyway, are handled by licensed escrow agents.
So far, yeah. Okay. Anything else?
Another thing I wanted to mention about tightening up the definition, it pulls out some language there in Section 1 where withholding may have been required under leases and other mortgages, for example, second mortgages or leases, and that was never really the intent because in those cases there isn't a transfer of property. So with the way the definitions work now under consideration, for example, it makes it very clear that it's the transfer of real estate that is the focus,
okay,
which was in line with the original intent.
Okay. Let's start with Tim Martinez and Ken Sherman.
Can we have some questions for Chris first?
Well, I suppose, if they're short.
Okay, Chris, I kind of remember this bill. If I remember right, the problem is people out of state that own property in Oregon, like a second home or a vacation home, sell it, make a profit, and don't pay their taxes.
That's correct, Senator.
That's basically what we're trying to get at.
Correct.
Okay. Will this bill make it easier or harder for people in that circumstance to not pay their taxes?
Well, I think you'll be hearing some testimony precisely to that point. As I read it, there's something of a trade-off. In kind of in general terms, you have administrative issues for perhaps some of the compliance issues on the periphery, if you will. And I believe you'll probably hear from the Department of Revenue. They're just now getting their feet wet with administering this. So it's kind of an incremental process in terms of trying to get the program up and going and then understanding problems and then fixing them later as opposed to trying to address every issue now. It also gives them the ability, the part of that, the compliance vein there is the paperwork in which they can follow up in terms of enforcing the compliance. It just escaped me. I had another part of an answer there.
Well, Madam Chair, are we going to hear from the Department of Revenue?
Yeah, they're here, and they're not signed up, but we will definitely drag them up along with Legislative Council.
Ask that you drag them up at some point.
Okay, but we're going to start out with the advocates here, so Mr. Martinez and Mr. Sherman.
Good afternoon, committee. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. To my right, familiar face to all of you, I think, Ken Sherman, Jr., longtime counsel for the Bankers Association. We gave you a heads up on this bill at your last meeting, so I'm going to be brief, and then I'll let Ken kind of handle his written testimony. But, you know, just to reiterate what we said at your meeting last year, it is not our intent here to change any substantive piece of the bill, the underlying bill. I think what we discovered as the rulemaking process was moving forward, and again, we commend the Department of Revenue for their efforts in working with us on this. I think you will hear them say that they are comfortable with this bill and these amendments. At least that's what I'm led to believe. The problem was, as we went through the rulemaking, we discovered, and I think in talking to Chair Barnhart and some members of this committee, as you were putting this bill together, you were kind of looking at it from the 25,000 foot level. And you knew what you were intending to do, and the problem was, as we started going through the rules at the ground level, there were some errors that needed to be fixed. And that's indeed all we're trying to do here. I think the answer to your question, Senator Monroe, is we're not trying to make it any harder or any easier. You know, these folks owe taxes, and we believe they should be paid. So we're trying to make it workable.
Your staff did a great job describing the bill. You know, it's only 6 pages, but you could think it was 100 listening to the description, because there are a lot of technical fixes that needed to be done. And again, we think we've accomplished that. So we've talked to the chair on the other side. He understands the issue as well. I believe he's ready to adopt these amendments, again, assuming the department is comfortable with them. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. And if not, I'd turn it over to Mr. Sherman.
Why don't we do Mr. Sherman, then we'll ask questions of both of you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Ken Sherman. I'm counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. I have an office here at 475 Court Street in Salem. We do support the enactment of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1101, and I would reiterate what your staff said, that despite the fact that these are gut-and-stuff amendments that are now before you, except for the applicability provisions of Section 2, they make only nominal changes from the original printed version of the bill. The changes that were incorporated into the original printed version are incorporated into the gut and stuff amendments as well. Senate Bill 1101 addresses the problems with ORS 314-258, which have come to light since that section of the ORS was enacted last session. Senate Bill 1101 would remedy these problems without detracting in any way from the purpose of the 2007 legislation, which was to withhold for taxes on income-producing real estate transactions that involve non-resident individuals and non-resident C corporations. Although House Bill 2592 was intended to apply only to real estate transactions that involve non-resident sellers, we learned during the rulemaking process that began last August that the bill actually comes into play on each and every real estate transaction on or after January 1 of this year, and that is closed by an escrow company or another authorized agent. And it comes into play regardless of whether there are any participants in that transaction who are non-residents, and it comes into play regardless of whether the transaction even involves any taxable gain. We discovered that regardless of legislative intent, the measure could easily be read to require either withholding or the application of an exception from the withholding requirement, not just at the time of closing of the transaction, but on each and every payment of an installment transaction that was closed. We discovered that implementation of House Bill 2592 would dramatically increase the cost of closing escrow services as title companies and other authorized agents reprogram their computers, spend additional time educating consumers on the withholding rule, and that's a big one, and storing huge volumes of new records for long periods of time. We discovered that the vagueness of the definitions in House Bill 2592 create questions about the scope of the bill, when the exemptions from withholding will apply, and how the amount to be withheld is to be calculated. Representatives of the Department of Revenue have worked diligently since last summer to draft administrative rules to implement this measure, and they went into effect just before the beginning of the year. They started that process by forming an advisory committee, including representatives from the title, lending, and other industries. And they've been extremely receptive to the input from those sources, and I believe they've done about as much as they possibly could do to make a very difficult piece of legislation as workable as possible. But throughout this process, there has been a growing recognition on the part of all involved that ORS 314-258 needs to be modified to reduce the burdens it imposes on customers and businesses, and to make the whole real estate transaction involving non-residents work more efficiently. The essential features of the bill now before you, the Dash 1 amendments, are as follows. It will leave intact, I say again, the fundamental requirement that when an escrow agent closes a transaction on Oregon real estate involving a non-resident individual or a non-resident C corporation as transferor, the agent will be required to withhold a portion of the transaction proceeds unless one of the exemptions for the withholding applies. it will more clearly define the scope of authorized agent to which the law applies, focusing on the licensed escrow agent who closed virtually all Oregon real estate transactions. It will more clearly define what constitutes a conveyance that triggers the requirement for withholding, excluding transactions that by their nature do not result in taxable gain. It will more clearly describe how the amount to be withheld is to be calculated. It will clarify that the withholding rule comes into play only at the closing of a transaction and not with respect to each installment payment on an installment transaction. It will reduce the paperwork burden on agents by streamlining the exemptions process, and it will apply to all transactions closing on or after January 1, 2008, thereby curing the problems which are actually occurring today under the current law. And on that point, I just want to point out that while the printed version of the bill, Senate Bill 1101, in Section 2 creates kind of an awkward mechanism for the Department of Revenue to make rules that would, in effect, make the effectiveness of these new rules retroactive to January 1, the Dash 1 amendments do a much more direct job by simply saying the Dash 1 rules will apply to all transactions on and after January 1. So that's the one substantive change that I find in the Dash 1 amendments from the original draft of the bill. We think this is an excellent bill. We've worked hard and I think with great cooperation among the interested parties to bring it about. We have we made it our guiding principle from the very beginning that we were not going to try to either reverse or reduce the impact of withholding on non-resident transactions. We were just going to try and clean it up and make it work better and more efficiently. So we joined with the Oregon Land Title Association, the Oregon Realtors, in support of this bill. Here today is Cleve Abbey, who represents the Oregon Land Title Association and has really worked very diligently with legislative counsel on the draft, and he's here to answer any technical questions you might have with regard to the draft. With that, I'll stop and thank you for your time, and I'll be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you. You mentioned that only licensed escrow agents are responsible for this reporting requirement, and yet some people do use lawyers, and that, in fact, if we limit it to only non-licensed or only to licensed escrow agents, there might actually be an incentive to use someone other than that created by the bill. Would you have a problem with including lawyers or others who act as an escrow agent?
Well, Madam Chair, that was one of the problems that we saw with the original bill, was that by broadening the scope of what constitutes an authorized agent, the original bill made that term so vague that we could conjure up all sorts of examples where people would be dragged in without knowing that they were being dragged in. Now, I'll tell you at the outset in answering your question that the other half of my practice, essentially, or about a third of my practice, is as a real estate lawyer, and I handle lots of real estate transactions. We never, ever have a real estate transaction in our office because there's just too much technical detail with all the RESPA forms and everything else, and we're just not set up, and I don't believe my colleagues in the profession are set up or are willing to take the liability to do that. So I don't really see that as a threat to the effectiveness of this bill. But the other thing I would say is that when we first became aware of the impact of this bill, there was some discussion, quite frankly, about the possibility that real estate transactions would be closed by out-of-state escrow companies. And I suppose that that possibility still exists under the current law. In other words, that people who really want to avoid this withholding for some reason would go to an escrow office in Vancouver, Washington or something and do their closing up there. I'm not sure that you can effectively close that loophole totally. What I would say is let's monitor this over the next 18 months. And frankly, if limiting this to escrow, licensed escrow agents, which do in fact close virtually all of the transactions, isn't effective, and if people are driving around this thing, we'll be back here supporting effects of that.
Well, by talking about licensed escrow agents, would this include the agents in Vancouver?
No, because the state of Oregon, Madam Chair, doesn't have jurisdiction over the life of the agents in Vancouver.
Hmm. Okay. Might call for some kind of provision if somebody intentionally takes evasive action to avoid it. There might be.
And as I say, Madam Chair, if that turns out to be a problem, whether we're talking about lawyers or licensed agents in Vancouver or anyone else, I would certainly support it. We are not opposed to the purpose of this bill, which is to collect those taxes from the non-resident sellers.
Okay. Any questions, Senator Monroe?
Well, I just that seems like a loophole to me that troubles me. It in fact does trouble me that because people that want to try to figure out a way to avoid taxes, if there's a loophole that allows them to do that, they're going to do that. Now, it might be true that in 95% of transactions people don't do that and they obey the law and so on, but you know, that other 5% is who we're all after, that that are looking and getting smart lawyers to show them ways of avoiding paying their taxes. And I'd rather, if we can figure out a way to close that loophole, I'd prefer it.
Well, one way to do it might be to require everyone who's engaging in one of these covered transfers to have a licensed escrow agent inside the state of Oregon.
That'd be good with me.
That might be possible. I think, Madam Chair, that would require an amendment to ORS Chapter 696, and I'm not sure that that would be within the purpose clause of this bill. But it might be. I'd want to be sure that you carefully consider all the ramifications of doing that. But it's certainly a possibility.
And I would just add, Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, if I could, that passing this bill, not passing this bill, the loophole of going to Vancouver still exists.
Yeah. The other thing that I would just point out is that if somebody, as Senator Monroe suggested, really wants to be smart about this, I suppose they could figure out how to close the transaction just between the parties and not involve an agent. And then there is nobody to point the gun of withholding responsibility at because there is no agent. So if you've got that smart taxpayer who just wants to avoid this at all costs, that's probably the easiest way to do that. And that, frankly, could happen under the current law, and it could happen under the Dash 1 amendments.
But not if they were required to use a licensed escrow agent for this type of transaction. But I hear what you're saying about the ramifications, because it's a bigger change than this bill. But we have legislative counsel in the room, so
sure. They're
very, very smart.
And Madam Chair, I looking at the relating clause, I think this relating clause would allow such an amendment.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If someone, for example, is a registered corporation in Washington and they choose to close this in Vancouver, wouldn't they have a tax liability under the state of Washington laws?
Fortunately, Senator Morris, you have Department of Revenue people here who are much more qualified to speak to that than I am. So I'm going to defer that question to them. I'm not a tax expert, and I'm not sure whether they would. I assume they would, but I'm not sure.
Senator Morris, do you have a follow-up?
Well, I'm just wondering. Thank you. I'm just wondering if it's as big a problem as we think it might be, if, in fact, they have a tax liability. Mm-hmm. By closing in an adjacent state. So that would be the question.
Senator Hess.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I was thinking not going through a licensed agent as an evasive action, but just as practice sometimes with family members.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is not uncommon, but yet that none of this would apply in either case.
Madam Chair, Senator Hast makes exactly the point that I was just trying to make. You do have transactions where, for whatever reason, family members or whatever, there is no agent involved. And in that situation, this bill, none of the bills that we've talked about would apply or require any withholding. So,
but in those transactions, the person still would owe the tax,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they still owe the tax.
So So the question would be how you wanted to apply the intent of this bill to those transactions. Mm-hmm.
Anything else? Any other questions? Oh, we just lost the other half of the room here. Is it something I said or something you said? Okay. We'll take our next. We're going to save the Department of Revenue and Legislative Council to back clean up on this one. So we'll have Mr. Monroe and Mr. Abbey next.
Madam Chair and remaining members of the committee, I'm Jack Monroe here today on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association, joined by Cleve Abbey, who's an Oregon Council for Land America. I think it really we're here to answer questions. I might just add a couple of comments. You know, clearly Mr. Sherman indicated that in the six-month development of the rules, we found technical problems. And, you know, obviously, among other things, one of the purposes of this legislative session was to deal with just that kind of a situation. And so a couple of months ago, we started working on what you see before you is 1101-1. And it's obviously directed toward dealing with those problems. I think as it relates to some of the questioning that's been here, certainly good questions, but, you know, you probably set out last session to create a perfect mousetrap, and you didn't. And it's quite possible that even in an amended form, again, as Mr. Sherman has mentioned, that we might find that there is some space between the slats or whatever you encounter, and I guess it wouldn't be new to this committee that you're sort of constantly working on tax-related legislation to perfect the model. And so that's certainly possible, and as Mr. Sherman indicated, we would certainly willingly participate in that process. In response, I guess, to the line of questioning about having narrowed the scope of authorized agents to authorize escrow operations, and Mr. Abbey can be more specific than I can, but, I mean, 99-point-some series of the transactions are closed by escrow agents, and Mr. Sherman indicated that there are a variety of reasons why somebody else, like an attorney, doesn't choose to do that. And you also indicated, or at least the questions before also made clear that regardless of the fact that there is an obligation on the part of somebody who falls within the scope of this, i.e. is a citizen or a C corporation from outside the state, they have an obligation to pay taxes that existed before the passage of the initial bill, would exist after the passage of this bill, and it is quite possible for somebody to affect one of those transactions without going through unauthorized escrow agent or an attorney or anybody else. So, but with that, we'd obviously be happy to answer, you know, any other questions you might have or take another shot at questions you've already asked. So,
other questions? Mr. Abbey, did you have anything to add?
Let me. I'm Cleve Abbey with Land America Lawyers Title Insurance Corporation. We're an escrow agent in the state. I'm here representing the Oregon Land Title Association, whose members issue title insurance and act as escrow agents. And I think Jack's exactly right. In excess of 99% of transactions in Oregon are closed by licensed escrow agents. Most transactions have licensed real estate agents in them, and most of them have mortgage lenders who are doing the financing, and both of those parties generally insist on a licensed escrow agent closing the transaction. So you've got dynamics in the marketplace that steer transactions through the licensed escrow agents, and so I think this does capture in excess of 99% of the transactions. Yes, there are loopholes, but I think what Mr. Sherman said about coming back if we find some holes later on is the right way to approach this. The bill, there are a lot of other benefits that have been spoken to about the bill where there were questions about does this apply to collection escrows where there are payments coming in every month? Does it apply to loan servicers who are taking payments for loans that are held by other banks and so forth? And one advantage of the bill is it clarifies that and makes it clear that it applies to what happens at the closing when the transfer of the real property occurs. And I'm happy to take any questions. Thanks.
Okay. Questions? Thank you very much. Sean Jellians. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Sean Jellians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. When we set out to put this bill together and this work group working on the rules, it certainly was the intent of the stakeholders and of the realtors to ensure that these payments were made by out-of-state sellers. We just felt this was clarifying who was responsible for the withholding, and we'd certainly express our gratitude to the Department of Revenue and their staff for working with us on this. I'd like to echo the comments of the previous commenters that if there is an issue after this goes forward, we'd be more than happy to come back here and attempt to address it in another way. And with that, I'd be happy to get out of the way and let the Department of Revenue come up here and answer any questions or try to answer any
questions. Thank you very much. We've got two people signed up who don't give their position, Jody Weiser and Tangela Purdom, so we'll bring them together. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Jody Weiser with Pax Furnace, Oregon, and this is Tangela, and we actually didn't see this bill until yesterday and didn't see the amendments till now, so we don't feel very prepared. We clearly were some of the interested parties, and we weren't involved in the process of opposing what was passed last session and the work that was done in the interim to develop regulations and how this would happen in our state. Our organization has some questions about the policies that were passed last year. We didn't think it was the most effective way to do this job, but we also didn't think it was an emergency. The state's already got the process in place. They're doing it. Real estate agents and title companies are handling it. And by the beginning of next session, we'll have a year's worth of records to find out how it's working and what needs to be fixed. Pretty much everything in the original law has been changed in some form or another, so it's very hard to diagnose what's really being done with this this bill. That it feels quite intentional that lawyers are left out, and there must be a reason for that. There must be a reason the Bankers Association was here testifying that they want this revision because they're not an escrow company, but they want this change somehow, so it makes me question things. They have eliminated installment payments, withholding on installment payments. 15 other states have withholding on installment payments. If you have a closing that happens on Tuesday and you have under this, it looks like under this, you have a transaction where you're receiving less than $100,000 that day, then there would be no withholding. If you have an installment payment due on Friday, there would be no withholding. So if you wanted to avoid withholding in the state, you would just simply set up a transaction where on the day of closing you get $90,000, and a week later then you get the rest of your money. And then there would be no withholding. So anyone who's adverse to paying taxes would have an easy way to do it if you don't have the follow-up of withholding if you're on installment payments. The states that have been doing this have found that taxpayers have found ways around them. That the people who don't want to pay taxes in Colorado, they have it if you're a person selling. So they started creating LLCs. And they were LLCs that were domiciled in the state of Colorado. The property was transferred to the LLC, and then the LLC sold it, and so there was no withholding. So it's clear that there are taxpayers who really don't want to pay withholding because they don't want their sale identified. One of the problems with the way the bill that was passed in 2007 is being put in place, the forms where you would sign under penalty of perjury, no, I am a resident of the state, so I shouldn't have withholding, are being left at the escrow office. And those forms should be transferred to the Department of Revenue where they can be reviewed. If you sign under penalty of perjury that you are a resident when you aren't a resident, and you know it's going to go into a file in the basement of a title company, it's not really a very effective tool. If you send it to the Department of Revenue where it can be reviewed, it's a much more effective tool. And so that would be another change that we would recommend, but we'd recommend it next year, not this year. There was a definition for corporations before that if they would no longer be doing business in the state immediately after the conveyance, then there would be withholding. That seems to have been eliminated in the change. It says on page 3, line 23, that the transfer may claim the amount withheld by an authorized agent as a credit on the transfer's personal income tax or corporate income tax return. I don't believe that withholding is a credit. I think those would be on different lines of your tax form. But we simply haven't had time to look at this and have people who we trust look at these words and make sure that what we're accomplishing here is where we want to go. It's unclear, it's hard to trace through in the time we've had today whether there's any penalty of perjury for every single person who is having a sale in our state. The other states always have you sign a thing, says, yes, I'm a resident. Takes no time at a closing. You have to sign a form that says, I'm a resident of this state. I mean, that's seconds that it takes to do that. If you're not a resident and you're trying to figure out how to say you don't want to have withholding, that might take some time. But if you're a legitimate member of the resident of the state, it's not going to take you any time to fill that form out. And a stack of closing documents is like this. One more page is not going to, you know, bog down the whole process. So what we would recommend to you, since we're under the tight timetable that we're on this session, is that you just say, let's try it for a year. Let's come back. Let's look at it. We might want to use the Maryland model. In the Maryland model, you don't transfer title at the county clerk's office. Or where does that
go? You do.
When you do it, you have to show that you've had the tax withheld. And so if you are a family member transferring title to another family member, then you have to deal with it. If you sold with an escrow agent in Vancouver, you're not going to transfer title without proof that you've had withholding. Mm-hmm. And in Maryland, if you don't want to pay the 2.5% that's withheld from the gross sales price of every sale, you go 21 days before the closing of the sale to the state and you present your documentation that shows how you figured out your basis, how you figured out your gain, what your situation is. They help you figure out what your tax is going to be, and the work is done. And the work is done with somebody who's got the documents in front of them and sits there and does it. The woman who does it brings in $20 million a year. And she finds not only that the people who weren't paying their capital gains tax, but the people who had apartment buildings and had never paid income tax in the state for the years that they owned the property in their state. So that would be a model we would recommend perhaps in 2009. But it doesn't seem like something a change we should try to make now when we haven't even tried our current system out and when we have very short time to really vet the process. So Tangela did some phone calling, and she'd like to talk to you about what she learned.
Okay, just very quickly because we're getting a little short on time.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Tangela Purdom, and I interviewed people in the business, realtors, title people, and one lawyer. And I found it very clear. This is my simple transaction for my last closing on a property here in Oregon. So this is just a really small packet, but that's typical of residential sales where there aren't huge complications, and we're all aware of that. We've probably all done it. I talked with the people in the title company. They said that everything's been going smoothly as of the yesterday. I found two title company people who do more than 700 transactions a year. Each had had two sales under this provision for out-of-state people. Both said there was no big deal involved. There are two pieces of paper they have to fill out. They have to see a tax person who, or they may call the state, and it is on the form that they fill out where they can call. And they've said that, people have chosen to pay the 4% out of those four people that we know about that had this. One did not have to pay, and that 4%, and they went through the process to do that as an exemption. That was a relocation. The person had relocated prior to closing, but they were able to show that they had lived here the bulk of the time of the property, and so somehow that came under the exemption as far as they know. Also, both title companies said that they have no problem giving the state the money, and they send the forms straight to the state in an envelope at closing, just like they do all these other documents. There are over 23 different withholdings that these title companies do on a regular basis. I'll save you the time, but just to jog your memory from the last sale you've done, and it's things like your mortgage insurance, your county tax. There's a Fannie Mae form that is automatic, always goes to the federal government under any sale. So those are the kinds of things they do. There's all kinds of, they'd have to deal with flood insurance, mortgage insurance, and so on. So we're used to that, and the business seems to be used to that. And these two gals seem to think that it was reasonable. They pay their taxes. Out-of-state people should pay theirs. I would also reiterate that Maryland has a very slick way of doing things. The title company really doesn't have to do a thing. They just are notified that 21 days prior to your closing transaction, you fill out their documents, and they're not onerous. They're 2-3 pages, and everybody does it. And then at time of recording of your deed, it will not be recorded unless you have a certificate from their Department of Revenue, and that Department of Revenue gives you that certificate, and it will say exactly how much money has to be paid. The county clerk's office forwards it to the state, and you're done. If there's an exemption, it's been done by the state. And it's very clear that each and every transaction then is done by a professional, and the state is getting their money. So I would again say what my colleague here has said, that I think we should live with this for the year and come back and revisit it. And certainly I have been on a number of committees as a stakeholder, and I'm quite surprised we were left out. One last little personal note I would like you to know. My mother happens to be an Alaska resident. She owns two properties here in the state of Oregon, and when I said what I was doing, she said, "I'd have to pay taxes in the state of Oregon. I'm an Alaska resident." And my mom's 81 years old, and she's very sharp. But she had no clue she would owe the tax, and I'm not sure she would have found out. When I talked to realtors and title people before we had this in place, this issue was not discussed. It simply wasn't ever brought up.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you both. Okay, Department of Revenue, Ms. Toswell, come on up and answer our technical questions. Ms. Harshenko, if you want to participate, you can as well. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue.
We did have a rulemaking process. We have a rule in place. In our forms and instructions, we're receiving payments. We did have challenges in developing the rule. We do look at the amendments to Senate Bill 1101, the dash one amendments, as being clarifying amendments to the law that was passed. We do appreciate the chance to work with the industry in developing those. My recollection is that Ms. Weiser was at the first meeting where we worked on the administrative rule. I may be incorrect about that, but that is my recollection. We, in the 07 session, did talk about coming back to the legislature in 09 to deal with not only this issue, but other areas of withholding on non-residents. We do have a provision in the law that requires withholding for certain non-residents who are partners in a partnership, for example. And then there's also a provision that requires that non-residents who do like-kind exchanges of property eventually report that gain back to Oregon and pay tax on that. Our hope was that we could look at those provisions holistically and develop some proposal that makes sense to deal with them all together rather than on a piecemeal basis. So at that time, we were hoping to address any further issues with this legislation. But we did run into issues. We do think there are some things that need to be clarified in it. If I may just address Senator Monroe's specific question about the non-resident who owns vacation property in Oregon, and will this make it easier? In a sense, it could if they're choosing to not use a licensed escrow agent in that transaction. But I must tell you, Senator, as someone who practiced as a CPA for some time before I came to the department, if a person is intent on either avoiding payment of tax or payment of withholding, there are ways to do it. Under the current law, if that's what I wanted to do as an Idaho resident owning Oregon property, I would dump that property into a limited liability company. The withholding rules wouldn't apply to me. Very simple, easy to do. File some paperwork, and that's it. This law and the amendment that we're talking about wouldn't change that. So if you're intent on doing it, you cannot write laws that will prevent all tax avoidance or all tax evasion. You do the best you can to get the largest population that you want to cover, but there's always someone who can figure out a way around it, and that's just how it works. So I'd be happy to try to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, Deb. My question was, will passing this bill make it easier for people in that circumstance to avoid their taxes?
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, I would not say it's going to make it easier. I would say that if someone wishes to avoid it now, they can. This law won't change that. What it would do is, rather than requiring them to take step A, maybe they could take step B. But they'll still be able to do step A if step B isn't available to them. So.
And second question. Deb. Will passing this bill make your job easier in terms of administering this law and collecting taxes that are owed?
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, I believe the Dash 1 amendments do clarify provisions in the law, and it would make it simpler for us to administer in that it makes it more clear as to what you intended for us to do.
Thank you.
Let me ask you that on the point about that Jody brought up about the installment withholding, would that be exempt from the bill? What do you have to say about that? I mean, can somebody get around it just by, you know, crafting the installments at a certain level so that they won't be subject?
Madam Chair, it's possible. For example, let's say that I'm going to sell my property for $1 million. And what I'm going to do is receive a $100,000 payment in 2008, and I'm going to receive the balance in 2009. So under that scenario, what is subject to withholding is just the $100,000, because that's the payment received in the year of transaction, assuming that's the net proceeds, et cetera. So that would be subject to withholding. The withholding would come in on that. The next year's payment would not be subject to withholding. So let's assume that we tried to fix that and say, all right, all of that's going to be subject to withholding. The entire $1 million will be subject to withholding. So you calculate it using the formula here. You send that withholding into the department. When they file the return, all we're going to do is send them back a refund because they're only reporting a portion of the gain as taxable. So they'll get all the money back anyway, because it's only what they owe, only the gain is going to be subject to tax. So trying to pull installment sales into this, I'm not sure is the best solution. There are other things that we could look at. For example, we could consider bonding. Maybe the taxpayer has to post a bond until they've reported all of the gain and paid tax. Perhaps there needs to be a lien on the property, the replacement property, until the taxes have been paid. And we talked about doing that with when we were doing the like-kind exchange bill several years ago. Perhaps there should be a lien attached to that, and when they satisfy the lien, then and the taxes are paid, then that's, the lien goes away. So there are different options to look at, but I don't know that we have a perfect answer as to how to make sure the taxes are paid when they're reporting gain over a number of years.
But under the existing law that we passed last session, they do have to report the installments. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, it's not clear because that is not addressed in the law now as to how you deal with installment transactions. Those were not in the language. The interpretation we have put into rule and into the forms and instructions is that what is subject to withholding is what occurs in the year of the sale. And the installment sales are not covered under our rule as we've interpreted them.
So as far as you're concerned, if we did something like a lien or a bond, that's something that the Department of Revenue could enforce?
Madam Chair, I haven't asked the program about that, but it's something that we would certainly consider. And we do put liens on property now in other programs, for example, the senior deferral. There's a lien on that property until the debt is satisfied. If you had Oregon property and they are selling that and acquiring out-of-state property, perhaps legislative counsel can help me on this. I don't know whether a lien on an out-of-state property is effective for Oregon tax purposes, but there could, if that doesn't work, there might be another solution, such as a bond, required.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Kate Hossel from Legislative Council. Just addressing the question as to the lien, that is something that would add add a layer of complexity to both the existing statute and the Dash 1 amendments, and I'd want to look into that.
Madam Chairman, may I just clarify my comment about the lien? I wasn't proposing that for this legislation, but in coming back in 09 or even 2011 with a big picture look at how non-residents are subject to withholding and tax on these types of transactions, that might be something to look at.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It would appear to me that we have Senate Bill 1082 that's an appropriate vehicle to continue this discussion in a more thoughtful, thorough way with respect to compliance. I suspect this issue is one of many that you will have, and so I think we can continue this discussion with Senate Bill 1082.
Madam Chairman, Senator Morris, I think that is an excellent observation.
Do you think this is a, obviously this is an issue that we could do now, we could wait till 2009. What do you see as the benefits of doing something on this now as opposed to waiting, keeping the whole issue till 2009?
Madam Chairman, as I said, we did have some issues in developing the administrative rule that we have on the books now. And the language that's in the bill in some areas is not entirely clear as to how it should be interpreted. Your staff mentioned the definition of closing and settlement services on line 10, including leases and including mortgages. And in our rule, we took the position that the legislature really did not intend for leases to be covered in the withholding provisions based on the testimony in the committee, that what you were looking at were real estate transactions. Yet leases are in the law. So there's a question as to whether or not our rule should have included leases and whether those should be subject to withholding. And yet if you think about how you would make leases subject to withholding, that's a whole other ballgame than a single transaction involving the sale of real estate. So it's that type of ambiguity in the bill that has caused us just a little bit of difficulty, and we would appreciate some clarification on that.
Questions? Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, committee. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill. We don't have anybody else, do we? 1101. And we're going to hang on to it since we just got the dashed one amendments. So this is already on the schedule on Friday. So we won't have to repost that or anything. And now we move on to our final bill. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1082 and switch economists here.
A revolving economist, Madam Chair. That's one of the benefits of the Revenue Committee. Members of the committee, we have Senate Bill 1082, which is the third of your committee introduced bills, pre-session filed bills. Senate Bill 1082 does a couple things. The main thing is it requires Department of Revenue to submit a report to the legislature by February 1, 2009 on individual taxpayer compliance. The Department of Revenue is directed to prepare the report using existing data, and that report should include an estimate of taxpayer compliance with existing law, identify taxpayer behavior that affects compliance, and then make recommendations to improve income tax compliance. In preparing the report, the department is to consult with your Legislative Revenue Office and other outside resources as necessary. Just a little bit of background on this issue and the Ways and Means. I believe Senator Morse was on the general government discussion last session in Ways and Means that talked about the tax gap or the difference between the amount of taxes collected versus what could theoretically be collected if given current law and the amount of potential taxable income. IRS has done some estimates of that. Some other states have done some estimates we've looked at. We have not done that formally up to this point, but that was discussed in discussions with the Department of Revenue. And I know that in the meantime, both of our House and Senate revenue chairs have met with the director of the department to talk about this issue. So some of the language you see in Senate Bill 1082 is based on discussions with Director Harchenko and the Department of Revenue.
Great. We do have a sign-up list, but I'm going to ask Ms. Harchenko to come up first and bring anybody you want.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Elizabeth Harchenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. The materials that you have from the department basically are two parts. One is to try to give you a little bit of the background of tax administration that the compliance issues should be considered in the context of. We try to use what we call a balanced approach to tax administration. We have a big system in the individual income tax program, particularly, where we're anticipating over 1.7 million returns during this processing season that's just begun. And it's very important for the state to have that system remain healthy and the infrastructure remain current and up to date. And so that's one of the areas that's we always are holding in mind. So to get people to be able to file timely, accurately, and to pay readily. We offer education and assistance, as well as making sure that we're trying to enforce the law when people don't comply readily. We try to work with people in a way that encourages them not only if they haven't done what they're supposed to do correctly and on time, that they understand what their obligation is, and that over the long term that they will continue to do what they need to do. We've given you some examples here of the way in which we provide education. We have a website where we have all of our forms and publications available. We also publish paper forms of our booklets and publications, and we offer classroom training to taxpayers and tax professionals. We have information sharing agreements with other states, with the federal government, and we participate in organizations of our peers around the country in order to make sure that we're aware of and implementing as many of the best practices as we can. We have a call center for people who can call toll-free in Oregon if they need help in understanding what their obligation is, or if they've got a debt that's owed, how much, and to make arrangements for payment. We work with small business, people new to business, or people who are in business to understand what their obligations are as taxpayers and as employers. And we assist with tax preparation for low-income and elderly taxpayers and offer other services. We have field offices around the state to assist in that. I asked for some information this morning. As of Monday, we had about 235,000 tax returns that had been filed already this season, 113,000 of those electronically, 120,000 using computer-assisted software with the barcode on them that we can read very, very quickly and allow us to process quickly. So we're really pleased to see that people are using technology in order to file. We just implemented on January 10th a new payment method that allows people to arrange for us to use a debit from a checking or a savings account to pay their taxes. And we did a soft launch, and over 500 taxpayers have already used it to pay almost $200,000 in liability. The enforcement steps that we take now include reviewing returns, verifying the amount of tax that people are reporting and paying, that they have the records to support that. We have a pretty active program for identifying people who should be filing and who are not, and to get them to file and pay the tax that they owe. And then we do have folks who file and say, I owe, but I can't pay. And so we work with them in order to get payment using payment plans and other kinds of tools. During the fiscal year 2005 to 2006, we audited about 32,000 personal income tax returns and assessed an additional $45.8 million in tax and collected about $75 million from taxpayers who filed but didn't pay what they owed at the time. So that just gives you kind of a background picture. We also do every biennium, we refresh our business plan, our six-year business plan. In the current plan, we had already planned to look at all of the studies that have been done across the country by states and by the Internal Revenue Service on taxpayer behavior and compliance issues, and are drawing together that information in order to focus on what is going to help us best to assure compliance in Oregon. We are always looking at different ways, including the direct debit option that we just put in place, to encourage taxpayers to be able to pay their tax easily. And we're going to continue to work on our strategies around collection and our filing enforcement program. So the bill will give us a more formal, formalize that work plan for us, and our intention to report back to you and to the Ways and Means Committee on our work and how we understand what drives taxpayer compliance in Oregon and what we can do to improve that. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. And after Friday, we might even be more interested in, in what you can come up with under those rocks. And also, I wanted to make sure that that you heard Senator Morris's excellent suggestion to include this whole area of out-of-state transactions and in compliance with the tax requirements there in the scope of your thing. I know it's a relatively small piece of what you're doing, but I think it's an excellent opportunity to take a new system that we have and take a look at it. And in the bill, it says that you're going to be doing research about other kinds of compliance, and you know, if the state of Maryland is doing it in a way that is very administratively simple and effective, then maybe that would be something that you could take a look at and see, or your department could take a look at and see if that is something that we should be considering here as a simpler way to do the same thing.
Madam Chair, our plan would be to, as has already been suggested in the conversation on the other bill, get it up and running, see how it works, see where the improvements are that can be made, and come back and talk to you in 2009 about that. So we would have been planning to do that anyway. The conversation we had in Ways and Means, as Paul recounted, was one in which members of our subcommittee and the general government subcommittee were very interested in hearing what are the things that in terms of from the resource side we might need in order to better achieve compliance, and so we would be going back to them also on issues that are within the scope of their ability to provide direction and assistance, and come to you with any policy recommendations. One other thing I did want to mention that's in my written material is that we do have some challenges that we also are trying to work through, and that includes recruitment and training of high-quality staff. There's a lot of competition right now for people with accounting backgrounds, and so we are struggling just a little bit with keeping the positions that we have authorized filled. We've also got some big projects that we're working on right now, technology-related projects. One is related to electronic filing. As you know, because of the connection we have with the Internal Revenue Code, we partner with and actually piggyback on the federal electronic filing system. And they are changing the platform that they're using for electronic filing, and so we've got quite a group of people working together with the service in order to make sure that as they make the shift to that new platform, we're able to make the shift at the same time. In the course of doing that work, we are also going to be able to provide electronic filing for corporations. We've had a few, I think it's about 25 during the month of January, that actually use the very beginnings of that process to file electronically their Oregon corporate returns. So we're hopeful that that also is going to provide a more efficient way for especially smaller business corporations to file. But it does take a lot of staff to make sure that works well. The other is a project that we started in early 2007, so towards the end of the 2005-2007 biennium, and is going to carry through this biennium and into the next two. That is a processing automation effort that will result in as much of a paperless income tax return processing system as we're able to create. And that, too, is taking a lot of energy and resource, and we're looking at that as a way to create a lot more efficiency for us. So we're doing the compliance work in that context. We know that it is very, very important. There's a lot more research that's being done at the federal level and by other states, and also by folks in the private sector, on what motivates taxpayers, what are the barriers to compliance, what are the incentives to compliance, and I'm looking forward to bringing back a comprehensive report to you so that you can see how Oregon fits into all that, whether there's anything special about our economy or our mix of taxpayers that would indicate certain things might be more effective here or less effective here.
Well, we look forward to seeing it. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we have some enthusiastic people signed up. I'm going to start with Jody Weiser, Lewis Payne, and Amy Ream. I'm going to have to ask you to be very short because we're almost out of time.
Jody's going to speak first, I think.
Okay. And let's be really, really quick. If we're really quick before I lose my committee, we can actually consider moving this.
Madam Chair, members of the commission, I'm Lewis Payne. I'm a member of Tax Fairness Oregon. and I'm going to speak just very briefly, given the time. It's difficult to imagine anyone who's opposed to this bill. We're being asked to vote in favor of motherhood, as near as I can tell. The whole purpose of the bill is to compel people to pay their fair share of the taxes. If there's anyone here who's opposed to that, please raise your hand. What we would like to say is that the tax gap, the difference between what is owed and what is collected, is not an insignificant figure. Nationally, the IRS commissioner said it was approximately $345 billion. Now, in 2006, DOR collected $5.9 billion in taxes here. Extrapolating, we've got a sheet in front of you explaining this. We came up with our research indicating that in Oregon, we had a gap of $1.5 billion. Not an insignificant amount of money. What can be done to address the severity of this problem? A number of things. Other states have had very successful programs in collecting the tax gap funds. I'll mention just a couple. In 2003, state of South Carolina appointed a new director of revenue, and that gentleman asked the legislature for $9 million and said with the $9 million, he would guarantee that DOR would collect $90 million or he'd immediately submit his resignation. In point of fact, they collected $113 million that year. Now, the fluke, a one-time thing? Not at all. As it happened, South Carolina, in their latest report, showed a return of $7.76 for every dollar invested in accelerating collections. South Carolina has 1.9 million people filing taxes. We had 1.7. So you can see we're roughly the same size state. In addition, taking a look at just one other, in a January 2007 report by Minnesota's DOR, they showed a return of $74.6 million from an increased expenditure of $9.5 million, a return of $7.85 for each dollar invested. The federal level, the IRS commissioner, estimated that the feds could collect $4 for each $1 invested. What we want to suggest is that our DOR be aggressively assisted by the legislature to attack this problem. As Archenko pointed out, a major problem we have is our salary schedule. The top of the pay scale for auditors, and we need more people than just auditors, it costs the state $60,000, including salary, benefit package, and ancillary costs involved in their employment. If we were to hire just 50, if we could find them, we're looking at an expenditure of $3 million and using the low estimate of the federal government, we're looking at a return of $12 million.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to wrap up your comments, right, if you could, so that we won't miss anybody.
Okay, yes. Okay. We urge you to aggressively assist the DOR.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Are you Mr. Moss?
Yes, I am.
Okay, Madam, I'm going to let you go next because you've got a couple of specific suggestions here.
Madam Chairman, my remarks, members of the committee, my remarks are basically contained in my written testimony.
Can you give your name for the record?
Oh, I'm Gil Moss. I'm sorry. All my remarks do is address some of the compliance issues raised in the bill, to add some suggestions. I think the bill's a good bill. It's a good start. I would recommend that business taxpayers be added to the reporting requirements. My written remarks contain some suggestions for the department's reporting on their compliance responsibilities through their enforcement program, and that's the substance of my remarks. Thank you.
I appreciate very much you being so brief and for giving us written testimony, because the thing about the business taxpayers, I think, is a very good point that we'll want to consider.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you.
Karen Burdick and members, thank you. My name is Amy Ream. I am not a tax expert. I'm a retired Oregon physician. In the last session, I lobbied in favor of Senate Bill 617, the brain injury bill. And our bill had support in both parties, in both houses, and it died in the Ways and Means Committee because there was not enough funding. And I take it rather personally, and I know the faces and the people, some of them at least, who have brain injuries and any other number of problems that we are unable to address because we don't have enough money. And so I urge the committee to aggressively pursue this as well. It feels to me, I can see money that's right there that's owed to us that is raining through our fingers. And it sounds like there's no state that has made this extra investment in enforcement that has not received a minimum of four times its money in return. So it sounds like a lot of money. However, it sounds like a no-brainer that we will get the money back many, many fold. And I urge you to aggressively pursue this expeditiously so that we can support our Oregonians who need it.
Thank you very much. Are there questions in this panel? Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. And we have one more person. Art Towers. Arthur Towers has something to say to us. Welcome.
Chair Burdick, member of the committees, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify extremely briefly in favor of this bill. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for SEIU Local 503. We represent the frontline workers in the Department of Revenue. Again, we support the legislation, and we urge both the Department, Revenue Office, and the committee to work with the frontline workers to examine ways to improve the quality of services the Department of Revenue provide. We really feel strongly that our frontline members can really be helpful in terms of ramping up enforcement, ramping up the efficiency, and really have insight that will be valuable to the process. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for being brief. Are there questions? Mr. Towers? Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I assume you'd like to move this today.
Well, I want to give a little thought to the testimony about including business taxpayers.
Well, that was the point I wanted to make. Was it would appear, given the relating clause, that we would require a new bill. Was that a hurdle?
You're right, Mr. Senator Morris.
And then the alternative to that, since this is a rather broad general recommendation, mm-hmm. why couldn't we verbally ask the department to be inclusive of business as well as individual and move this bill out?
Okay, I think that's a good suggestion. I hadn't noticed that the word individual was in the relating clause. Everyone, Mr. Moss, back there, just you probably are aware of relating clauses. You can't put amendments in that go beyond the scope of the relating clause. I thought your suggestion was very good, and I think Senator Morris's suggestion is good as well. So since you brought it up, Senator Morris, we will close this public hearing, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 1082. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move the adoption of Senate Bill 1082, and that it be referred to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 1082 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection?
Yes.
You object?
Yes, I object not on the basis of this bill, but, and I'm going to serve notice of a possible minority report. I think that that we can improve on this bill. So I don't object to the base bill, but I think that there's ways that we can improve it.
Well, it's nice of you to have said something before now. Did you want to elaborate on what your objections to the bill were?
Since there's no objections to the base bill, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Would you please call the roll?
No.
Senator Hess?
Yes.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Yes, aye. I'm giving votes no in serve notice of a possible minority vote.
Aye.
Aye. Senator Morris, would you like to carry this bill?
I would be delighted. Thank you.
Senator Morris will carry this bill, and we are adjourned.
But we are supposed to meet on Friday.
We really don't have time to
Is that a morning meeting?
Yeah, it's 10 o'clock. So the House committee has invited us, or invited you, at 10 o'clock in the hearing room F for the 4th.